Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field. So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're going to continue our rural surgery theme with Dr. Gary Timmerman. He's the ACRS member and past chair of the ACS Board of Governors Executive Committee. He's a general surgeon and professor and chair of the University of South Dakota Sanford School of Medicine and Sanford Medical Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Dr. Timmerman, thanks for joining us.
Very much an honor to be here. Thank you.
Could you give us a little bit of background about where you're from, where you grew up, and a little bit about your training?
I would tell you that I listened not long ago to one of your programs with Dr. Keith Willimo, and Keith and I are colleagues. We've known each other for years. We're both South Dakota products. I was born and raised in the northeast part of the state, a little town called Watertown, South Dakota. In South Dakota, though, although the population was only about 20,000, it was the fifth largest city in the state. Was raised there, went to high school there, did my undergraduate training at South Dakota State University, and then went to, like Dr. Lomo, 2 years at the University of South Dakota, and then was fortunate to transfer and be accepted to Washington University in St. Louis, where I completed my medical studies and then earned my medical doctorate. From there, I had the opportunity to go to, at the time, a somewhat unknown but rising program, Rush Presbyterian, and did my 5 years of surgical training at Rush Pres St. Luke's, and very honored and pleased to be a product of their fine program. From there, I actually always had intentions to going back to my hometown, and was extended an offer and went back to Watertown, South Dakota, and did surgery there, general surgery there, for nearly 10 years. I left Watertown about 18 years ago to Sioux Falls, primarily because of the somewhat advanced training I had the opportunity to gain while I was in Chicago, and they were in the process of doing things with Level 2 and Level 3 trauma centers, and they needed someone that knew something about that. So I had the opportunity to go to Sioux Falls and then manage the Sanford Hospital Trauma Service for 10 years, became a Level 2 trauma center, and then from there got involved with the medical school, and kind of the rest is history there.
Okay, well, we're going to jump into the field of rural surgery, and likely a lot because of your background and growing up in South Dakota, were there any other reasons you decided to leave the big city of Chicago and to focus your career in rural surgery?
You know, I'd love to tell you that it was for the money, but it's not. I went to South Dakota because I knew the value. I knew the opportunity for surgical care. I recognized the need for surgery, and I had family back here. So I did come back and have never, ever regretted coming back to South Dakota. And again, it was always my dream to go back to my hometown, where I practiced a wide breadth of general surgery, everything from fundamental orthopedics to all the thoracic, all the vascular, and certainly all the trauma, and then very much set the relative standard of care for general surgery while we were there. So never, ever had thought about staying in St. Louis or Chicago or any other place. You would find in South Dakota that, as you know, likely there were no surgical training programs, so all the surgeons from South Dakota come from other training programs, typically bigger programs, and come back to South Dakota. And I think one time we looked at a statistic that looked at around 80% of the surgeons currently practicing in South Dakota are originally from either North or South Dakota or Minnesota. So it's a very common thing that surgeons from this location will come back.
Dr. Timmerman, my next question is jumping into the actual reason why we're doing this podcast and to investigate the reason why there's a shortage of surgeons in rural surgery. Why do you think this is, and do you notice this shortage like on a daily basis? Does it impact you at all?
Yes, it certainly does. Again, for historical background, when I came to South Dakota, for the whole state of South Dakota, there were upwards of 200 general surgeons in the state for the whole state. And in my almost 30 years of being back, we're down to about 105. And that, and being lost mostly to retirement. And when they leave, regrettably, many of the communities that formerly would sponsor these surgeons have significant difficulty with maintaining an open hospital. There are about 52 hospitals in South Dakota, 38 or 7 of them are critical access hospitals. But back when I came back to the state, half of those had surgeons in them. And so even though, as you might envision a rural community being anything less than 50,000, remember that, as I mentioned, Watertown was a community of 20,000, and it was the fifth largest community. So it was actually a referral center in many ways for that entire geographic part of the state. What's happened is that I think as we looked at the crisis of rural health care, we noted a number of issues. One was actually what is the volume of general surgeons that we're producing today. When I trained, about 45 to 50% of my colleagues went into specialty training, and the other 50% stayed in general surgery. Well, I know you're well aware of the volume now. It's more like 15 to 20% will stay in general surgery, and the other 80% will select a specialty. And many of our specialties today that we select do entail more advanced equipment, more advanced economic means to support that surgeon, and therefore it's not as appetizing for someone to come back to an area that may not have the access to that financial backing. I think the statistic is anywhere between 200 and some to 220 or so general surgeons today are being finished in medical schools, in residency programs, then looking for jobs across the United States. Regrettably, I again heard a statistic that there's well over 1,000 general surgeons retiring every year. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out that we are not replenishing the general surgeons with the current volume that we have being produced in our residency. As I also mentioned then, part of that too, of course, is funding. GME funding is always a battle to keep people interested in going into general surgery. The resident hours and the length that it takes to train always has been somewhat of a factor that dissuades people from going into surgery. And then other concerns as far as the residents concerned, are the residents feeling after 5 years of training that they're ready to come out to a Watertown, South Dakota and hang a shingle? I would venture to say most don't feel that comfortable, and most are looking for somebody there to be with them. Well, 10 years ago, that might have been the case, but now 10 years later, a lot of those waiting to have a general surgeon join their group, they themselves have retired, leaving that community a bit in the lurch. The other difficulties we have are geographic. A lot of our communities, folks are moving to the cities where there's better job opportunities. The population left behind in these smaller communities is an aging population, higher percentages of Medicare and even Medicaid patients, so the financial returns aren't as appealing to perhaps staying in the cities. There's issues then now and in our own practices, in our own research that talks about volume, and if you're not doing a certain volume, immediately they say you're not competent. I take issue with that. I would say that, volume is certainly important, but I don't know that it necessarily speaks to competency of the physician or the surgeon. Oftentimes more speaks to the availability of all the resources available to that patient. And we can touch on a little bit later as to, when then do we decide to transfer somebody if you're not as comfortable doing it. I think, again, I mentioned surgical expense for equipment. My goodness, the Da Vinci has completely increased the need for economic backing for a surgeon, and if you're in specific specialties, it's almost expected that you're going to be doing those Da Vinci procedures. And there's a lot of smaller community hospitals that struggle even buying up-to-date and up-to-the-second new laparoscopic equipment, let alone some of the newer, higher-tech things that might come along the way. So I've mentioned just a few. I'll mention one more is even the specialty. More and more surgery has become a team sport where we have a number of people that are involved in the care of the patient, not just the surgeon. That entails perhaps GI services, entails perhaps cardiology or interventional radiology. Well, most of these smaller communities have a difficult time obtaining general surgeons to do that, let alone then all these specialties. And many of the disease processes now are measured not just by your outcomes, but also by your team assembled that will assist in improving your outcomes. So these are, my goodness, I think I gave you five or six different reasons why there's a struggle for folks wanting to come to the rural community. On the other side of that, though, we still have to recognize that over 25% of our United States population is considered rural. And then we're asking those rural patients to, in my state, go great distances, often in inclement weather. As of today, even in my home state, as I visit with you on the phone, right now it's 4 degrees above zero. It warmed up. This morning when I went in to make rounds, it was 9 below zero. And that's the true temp with a wind chill of about 40 below. Well, if someone has appendicitis 2 hours from here, the risk is not only getting to the hospital or getting to a surgeon, but are the roads available for them to get there? So all of these are the struggles that we have here in the upper Midwest and in rural areas.
Great. Well, I was wondering if you could just maybe take us through what a typical week's like for you out there in the community. What percentage of endoscopies are you doing? How much clinic are you seeing? What kind of cases are you doing? How much call and what's your lifestyle like?
Well, as I have changed my focus of my practice more toward surgical education and medical education, I've cut back quite a bit on many of my clinical responsibilities. So I'm pretty much half-time faculty for education, the academic aspect, and then the other is my clinical. A typical week now for me, I have several partners, which again, Sioux Falls, in your eyes, I'm sure, is seen as relatively rural. We're the biggest act here for about 250 miles surrounding, and so we're very much a large hospital. Sanford is just a little over 500 beds, so we're a very big institution, and I have currently 13 partners that assist with me, so it's not really fair to say I'm purely rural. But I can tell you that we still function that way, and we certainly still appreciate what our fellow surgeons outside of this community have to deal with. A typical day for me, though, will be many off-clinic, maybe once or twice a week for about 4 to 6 hours, seeing anywhere from 8 to 20 patients in that clinic. I've pretty much focused now on foregut surgery, so I do the majority of the esophageal, stomach, and pancreatic work, and then I smile, but I say I dabble in this next field just to keep my wits about me, is thyroids and parathyroids. Beauty of those, of course, is that patients typically don't have a lot of pain, and they will either go home the same day or the next day and recover very fast, as opposed to an open esophagectomy or an open Whipple, where, of course, you're doing all the things to keep them righted, if you will, for the next 6 to 7 days before they go home. So that's pretty much my practice. I can tell you, endoscopy-wise, again, I'm probably more along the lines of a rural surgery. I still do an average of 5 to 7 colonoscopies a week, and anywhere from 1 to 5 upper endoscopies a week. I do all of my own dilatations at often will put in my own stents. I'll certainly do some of the lesser invasive colonoscopy procedures, but that's very much compatible with my practice. When I was in Watertown, I would tell you that it was quite a bit different. It was 7 days a week. It was call every other night because I had one partner, and typically, we covered the ER, not only for surgery, but because there weren't as many physicians, I also did a lot of general admission for general medicine admissions, but happily always be able to say I had an internist or an OB or somebody on backup. In my years in Watertown, I would tell you that conservatively did over a couple thousand C-sections with my OB doctor. And so the breadth of my operative experience was a lot greater, as I'd mentioned before, in Watertown. and perhaps more limited due to the fact we have more specialties in Sioux Falls.
So, Dr. Timmerman, circling back to something you mentioned earlier, you spoke about volume and resources, and we see this go up against the trend towards centers of excellence in many areas of surgery, whether it be rectal cancer or bariatrics or pancreatic surgery. We've heard from some of the previous guests on Behind the Knife from the centers of excellence point of view. I'd be curious about your thoughts from about this concept of movement towards centers of excellence, and is it something that's feasible in the rural community? Is it something that we're going to be able to move towards, and what are your thoughts on this entire topic?
Well, it's a great question. You know, do you even train people to do major GI esophagectomies, Whipples, if they have no intention to go out to the Midwest, or if they have no intentions rather to stay in the Midwest, and now we're judging competency based on a volume, not necessarily outcomes. I can tell you that when I practiced in Watertown, maybe there's some colleagues that would cringe, but I did an average of 3 to 5 esophagectomies in that community a year while I was there. But of course, I also ran the ventilator. I did all the critical care, and I did all the post-op care because I felt very competent and well-trained to do that. I don't know today if surgeons are as comfortable doing that, especially, again, as we've made this more of a team sport. And so to ask a surgeon to come to that community and say, well, Timmerman did esophagectomies, we'd like you to do esophagectomies, I would be very nervous if I didn't have that same level of experience and training that I had. And so I certainly wouldn't want to force any surgeon to do something they're not comfortable with. At the same time, if they're doing an open gallbladder because they couldn't get it done laparoscopically and they get to a point in which they have to decide, do I proceed with a resection because what I thought was biliary disease is in fact a pancreatic mass, or do I bail at that time and close and send them to another center? Well, if there's a blizzard raging outside, which guess what, it does happen fairly common here in South Dakota, and your availability even to get a helicopter to that place may be limited for the next 3 to 4 days. Have we done that patient a service? I don't know. I think as I'm training now our new surgical residency program, which we just started 2 years ago, we're trying to figure that out ourselves. We're trying to give them the insight as to know when to pull out and when not to, because what our goal is to do is to train rural surgeons and make them feel comfortable about what they should be doing. But would I say to them, I expect you to do Whipples in a community of 20,000 and you may only see one a year? I would hope I've given them the insight that they should not do that. There are those, though, that have done that and had good results. There are those that patients that refuse to go to a center because of family and the like and would choose a lesser quality of care. I know that seems crazy perhaps to you, but there are a number of patients that would almost, I hate to say it, accept lesser care or perhaps lower quality of care in favor of knowing that their family is with them, that they are around support and love, and that their loved one wouldn't have to travel 4 to 6 hours to be with that individual as they recover, and then knowing that they'd have to make their trips back for their follow-up. That can be a real issue. So do I have an opinion? I think that we should hold them to the same standard of outcomes as we do a Chicago or a New York or an L.A. or San Francisco.
Okay, sir. Going back to your time at Watertown and reflecting back on that, what advice would you give to a rural surgeon out there that has a trauma patient coming in and deciding when they should transfer directly out by a medevac or whatever it may be versus taking care of that patient to the full extent in their community hospital?
That's a great question for us because just within the last 2 years, we finally set up a statewide trauma system that now does just exactly what you talk about, education to surgeons, such that the level of trauma care is relatively equal across our whole state. We have yearly meetings with all the providers that do trauma. They're asked to attend. They do attend. There are now legal requirements for them maintaining their ATLS certification. we were the last state in our entire upper Midwest to make a statewide trauma system. And now, happily, I can tell you, I'm the state trauma director for this, that we have seen tremendous improvement of getting the patients where they need to be as soon as they can. So with education and the mandate of education has come an increased ability to talk to that surgeon and say, you know what, yeah, I know you could do this or that, but this head injury was something that needed to be done, and still following the requirements of ABC of trauma, if they're compatible with comfortable taking out the hemorrhaging spleen and there's no IR there, and they have, that's the only way to save the life before they address the head, we're all for that. You know, save the patient and deal with the head, and then they have the helicopter waiting for them. They go straight from the OR to the helicopter and down to a more definitive care for their neurological injuries. It has been a successful work in progress in our state. I'm very, very proud of our providers here, and I think we have raised the bar to increase consistency across the state. I tell you, when we started in this state, when we started looking at that, you may find this interesting, but our number two industry is vacation and recreation in the state of South Dakota. And if you were traveling across our state and got in a motor vehicle crash and called 911, there was a very good likelihood, if you were from New York, your phone would ring you back to New York, and those operators would answer it and try to figure out how to help you while you're on an interstate in South Dakota. That was totally unknown to our state of transport, our Department of Transportation and our Department of Health until we started looking into this. So, I mean, even the logistics of making a statewide trauma system so that our customers that come into South Dakota feel that if they went to a small community, they know that that place practices outcome-based trauma care, I think is a reassurance to the customer that comes to South Dakota, be it for pheasant hunting or be it for looking at Mount Rushmore or looking at the Badlands.
A question I had is that do you find that when you're in a rural setting that you operate differently than you would if you were in a major, you know, the ivory tower academic institution? In other words, you know, do you say, well, you know, I'll leave a drain in this patient, whereas maybe you wouldn't, or I'll divert this particular patient, where maybe you wouldn't, if you're in a different hospital?
That's a great question, and we argue about this at our M&M, because one day I became the old guy. I don't know when that was, but I do a lot of things that perhaps folks don't do anymore, but not because of where I practice, but because of the successes I've had in the past. And I'm the first to look at things that say, this is a good thing, we should do this, we should do that. But there are still things I do that I know equal good outcomes for me. And if they're at all questionable, I love the residents because they challenge me on those all the time. But it's probably more generational than it is locational. As far as, you know, there were things I did in Watertown that I wouldn't do in Sioux Falls. I didn't have the immediate availability of IR to take care of a number of the trauma things that we do today. And so there, in fact, little I, the fact that, you know, back then it was not all that uncommon for us to address splenic injuries with hypotension and questionable continued bleeding with splenectomy, whereas today we would, if we got to that point, certainly consider an IR intervention to try to preserve that. But that also changes, you know, as trauma has changed its opinion on blunt trauma to the liver and to the spleen. But again, those resources were not as readily available to me in Watertown as they are here in Sioux Falls. I would like to think quality of my care is the same here in a larger community as it was when I was in Watertown, and I don't think I've ever jeopardized the patient based on my ability to perform the right operation at the right time.
So wrapping up a theme about the rural surgeon, obviously Kevin and Jason and John are active duty military. I spent a long time in the military, and one of the things that we'd often hear is that the military surgeons, along with the rural surgeons, are the true last general surgeon. I'm very curious as to what you think the future holds for the rural general surgeon.
Great question. I would tell you, in an answer to try to preserve the general surgeon. We started a general surgery residency program here, and we're in our completing or in the middle of our second year of that, with the intent to train more rural general surgeons and giving them a lot of what we heard was, I don't know if I feel comfortable or I don't know that I saw enough. And so the emphasis of our program that we made here was to give them kind of old school training like what we had 25, 30 years ago, where in our particular program you'll learn OB-GYN, you'll learn ortho. And we're very blessed in that we have no competing residencies in those specialties, and therefore when you do general surgery and do OB-GYN, you're really doing the OB-GYN. You're not just taking care of the post-ops on the floor. That's how committed I am to trying to replenish the rural general surgeons, but I don't see a lot of hospitals reopening that have closed, and because today it's such an economic undertaking to resume those, I guess, equipment requirements, update requirements, all the health policy requirements, all of the regulations. Therefore, I'm struggling mightily to keep the hospitals we have open with some relative potential to offer those hospitals future general surgeons that we like to think will be able to do the general surgery that was done there over all the years. And so, as I mentioned, we'd had a couple of dozen critical access hospitals that had general surgeons in them. I don't think we'll ever get to that point again, and I do think there'll be increased regionalization, not that families and patients wouldn't love to have that, but economics just say no. Our issues here are mostly of geographic and the ability to get excellent care across the state, even in a critical access hospital. And that I think every patient that comes into a critical access hospital has the right to the same quality care as they went into a level one trauma center in Chicago where I did my trauma. So to what end we can do that to get them to that area promptly, and again, we've put resources toward transfer, and so our hospitals in Sioux Falls and Rapid City have a number of helicopters and fixed wings that go out, but again, a lot of that's weather dependent as well.
All right, sir. Well, now it's time for our segment called Tips and Tricks, and this is where we ask our experts to their advice on helping us get out of those more tricky situations. And as Dr. Steele mentioned, you know, we're all military guys, and like the rural surgeon, we will often find ourselves doing things that are a little bit outside of our wheelhouse. So you had mentioned that you have performed, you know, thousands of C-sections, and that's something that I see us one day having to do, and it's not part of our training. So I was hoping that maybe you could take us through, maybe walk us through quickly how to do a C-section and what are the important steps and things to keep in mind.
Well, I need to preface this by saying I haven't been involved in a C-section over 18 years. So I would tell you that, and as we did C-sections, typically the OB doctor in my hometown was still there, and I was either the first assist or she'd be good enough to let me do it, and she would first assist. But really, so it's been 20 years. I don't know if I could tell you all the details. I can tell you that when the baby needs to come out in a hurry, you can move very, very rapidly and get to a baby. And I've never been so impressed by our OB colleagues as to how quick they can get down with literally 2 to 3 slashes of a knife and still not injure the baby and have the baby out typically in under 30 to 40 seconds. As I would watch this, I realized that, you know, we as general surgeons like to think we're pretty good, but we have some phenomenal colleagues of which you can learn from and see technique that when, you know, what hits the fan, they can do an operation as quickly as we can take out a spleen. It reminded me of the days of, not that I lived it, but as they talked about the Civil War and how quick a field surgeon could amputate a leg. And it is, I would say, probably the biggest thing as we're now teaching residents how to do C-sections, having them, how would I say, open their mind to the idea that they're not just the only people in town that can do great surgery. And these individuals, the OB doctors, are so elated to teach surgical residents because they know that they will be the one that have to do that C-section, and there's no way a helicopter can get them to a location. That baby will expire before they can get them there. And so I guess I would rather I defer of talking a pearl on how to do it in exchange of recognizing the talents of our colleagues and directing our current residents into that such that they would be competent and confident to do that in an emergency situation.
Well, maybe a better question then is why isn't this part of a general surgeon's training, and should it be a requirement for a general surgery residency to have some exposure to that?
Well, in a small community, typically there's absolutely no way a smaller community can afford a OB-GYN and a general surgeon. And oftentimes even an orthopedic surgeon. And the general surgeon is truly the general surgeon of all specialties. I mentioned right off the bat when I went to Watertown for many, many procedures, I was the standard of care. The general surgeon without specialty in that community is the standard of care. And therefore, that general surgeon needs to know one's own capabilities and limitations to be able to say that this standard of care would measure for this colon resection as it would in Sioux Falls. Or at the same time, if I can't provide that standard of care, then I have to have the wherewithal to know to transfer it so it can get this higher standard of care.
Great. And that leads us to our final five. These are five quick hit questions to get to know our interviewees a little better. Our first question, sir, is do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what kind of music?
Yeah, I do. It's 70s, all 70s, everything 70s.
The second question I have, do you have any hobbies, talents of interest outside the operating room or, you know, your practices in South Dakota?
Yeah, everybody in Sioux Falls knows that I'm a rabid bow hunter, and I bow hunt white-tailed deer, and I would tell you right off the bat I'm not very successful, but it is the whole idea of bow hunting, which is an entirely different experience than rifle hunting, mainly because of the challenges and the things you need to do to get up and personal with the deer.
Is that a crossbow or is that a compound bow?
Oh, no. It's a compound, mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think whether or not I have the courage to go to a longbow.
Oh,
but right
go.
Now, it's a standard a mechanical bow. Yep.
Okay. Well, I can tell you I use a Matthews Z7, so
Matthews Z7 Extreme.
Yeah, that's what I got, so it's...
absolutely great bow.
Yeah, it's a great bow. So question number three, can you tell us about a favorite trip or vacation, maybe this time of year, considering what's going on in South Dakota, that you've had recently?
This past June, my wife and I took kind of her dream vacation, and we went, and it was very much, I was in favor of it, to the south of France, and spent a week on a tour doing wine tasting and looking over communities in the south of France, the Provence area, and the like. It was fabulous.
Yeah, that sounds pretty great. Question number four, we ask all our listeners, what would they be doing if they were not in medicine?
I don't know. People have asked me that, and I so love what I do that I don't know. But I think, and tipping my hat to you folks, I would be probably in the military. And I would probably, I always really enjoyed the Air Force, and I probably would have done something along those lines. But my biggest regret in my life is I never did serve in our armed forces. But I like to think I do, we have a VA here, and I do endoscopy on VA patients and have my opportunity to give back to them that way. And yet I greatly respect the military and have nothing but the highest regard for our vets.
All right, last one, number five. If you could go back in time and meet yourself on the first day of your surgical internship, what one piece of advice would you give yourself?
it'll be okay. You'll get there. I, like most, are overachievers, and probably let a lot of cool things in my life go by because I was too fixed on the prize at the end. And I had a very nice friend just yesterday send me a text that I had been through some medical things myself, and he said, "Gary, you got to slow down." And his very nice comment was, "Don't you realize you've already seized the day?" And to me, that was very humbling, and Rick made me realize that, no, I don't know that I have yet, but maybe in many ways I have. And that's probably the one thing I'd say, that, gosh, Gary, slow down and enjoy some of the trip along the way.
Well, Dr. Timmerman, we've really enjoyed having you on the program today, and we're going to be releasing this at the end of the month. And so thank you for joining us and helping to educate our listeners about rural surgery.
It's been very much my pleasure, honor, and I'm very humbled to have been asked. Thank you.
Well, we all hope you enjoyed our interview with Dr. Gary Timmerman. That does conclude our two-part series on rural surgery. But we are, you know, looking for other rural surgeons out there that might be good to have on the podcast and maybe give us some interesting stories. So if you have any suggestions, send them our way. Other than that, we're working on a global surgery podcast that we should have out in the near future. We do apologize for a little bit of background noise during this past podcast, but sometimes that's just unavoidable.
Until next time, dominate the day.